may be seated. We're ready to proceed on the Humble Sand and Gravel versus Jose Martinez. Counsel, we've heard 40 minutes of arguments in some coach's case. If you can get some time back, we'd appreciate it.
May it please the court, Mr. Richard Ayashiki will present arguments of the petitioners. Petitioners have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. Good morning. I am Richard Sheehy from Houston. I am here as counsel of record for Lone Star Industries, though I am speaking to you this morning on behalf of all the petitioners. As always, I'm honored to be before the court. This case presents the clear question about whether actual or constructive knowledge of the permanent nature of an illness or an injury should control accrual of a cause of action for purposes of the statute of limitations in latent disease cases. And as Justice Gonzalez just mentioned, I know that you have heard 40 minutes, and I will try to be very brief with you. But this case does present a very different fact situation. I also know that the court is familiar with the facts, but I have a blow-up here, which I think sets forth the important dates, and I'd like to review them very briefly with you. The first important date, in 1985, this plaintiff learns that his brother is ill with silicosis. His brother was a sandblaster, and he knows silicosis is caused by breathing dust. On August the 31st of 1989, this plaintiff claimed that he had the first manifestation of an occupational lung disease, and in September of 1989, filed a workers' compensation claim in which he says that he has a lung disease arising out of the course of his employment. A year later, in 1990, he is referred by his lawyer to a doctor who advises a biopsy, although the doctor does tell him that there is a problem. In 1991, the biopsy is conducted. In October of 91, the plaintiff is told he has silicosis, and then he files this lawsuit in August of 1992.
Why is there a gap of a year between the date he was told that the biopsy was advised, and there's nothing for a year to get that biopsy?
That's obviously one of our points, Your Honor. I think the evidence read in a light very favorable to the plaintiff is that he claims he didn't have money to do it, and that there were financial reasons why he did not have the biopsy done. I do not think the record reflects any medical reason why that was not done. Keeping in mind, of course, that his lawyer is the one, obviously, who paid for the biopsy and also paid for the initial consultation, so I wonder, as we all should, why, in fact, the medical treatment wasn't sought earlier. And this does lead me to an argument I'm going to make a little bit later, but I will make it here because it fits, and that is the application of the statute of limitations in this particular case to bar this claim is not unfair. Because in 1989, the plaintiff claims that he has this injury or this illness, and had he sought the medical treatment earlier, and had he gotten the biopsy earlier, he clearly could have filed his third-party action within 2 years of the date that he had manifestation of the injury or the illness. So there's nothing unfair here with holding Mr. Martinez to his duty of inquiry in August of 1989, because, in fact, he could have filed suit timely had he seen the doctors quickly. In listening to the arguments a little bit earlier, there are some interesting things that we talk about in terms of the discovery rule. And if I may, I think the problem lies in the way that the courts have described the rule. The courts have done it in a way that has subtle differences. Now, this court, up until now, has indicated that the discovery rule stops, that is, the cause of action starts to accrue for limitations purposes when we have knowledge of the injury, either actual or constructive knowledge of the injury. There are cases in the courts of appeals in which the courts have held knowledge of the injury plus, in general, knowledge of the cause. There are other courts that say it is when a party has a duty to make inquiry as to whether that party has a cause of action. There are differences among those tests, which is reflected in the first case or the second case the court heard this morning, the case right before us. Because if the question is fact of injury, that's a separate accrual point than fact of injury and, in general, cause. Now, in this case, we do not have that problem. Because in this case, we know that the plaintiff has knowledge of the fact of injury no later than August 31st of 1989. We also know that he has knowledge of the fact of injury and, in general terms, the cause by 1989, because he says, I have a lung disease arising out of my employment. My brother has the same symptoms. My brother had the same disease, silicosis, caused by inhaling dust. So in this particular case, whether the court adopts knowledge of injury or knowledge of injury plus cause in general is irrelevant for purposes here because we meet both tests. The third test that is announced, of course, is the inquiry into legal rights. Once again, in this case, we have met it because the plaintiff did exactly that in September of 1989, felt bad enough to hire a lawyer and to pursue a workers' compensation claim for occupational injury. So under any standard, up until the Court of Appeals opinion in this case, the statute of limitations began to run no later than August 31st or 1989, or at latest September of 1989, when the workers' compensation claim was filed. Why we are here, I submit, is because the Court of Appeals engrafted an additional requirement onto the accrual rule, and that is the court held not only does the plaintiff have to know constructively or actually knowledge of the fact of injury and perhaps knowledge of generally the cause and not only have a duty to inquire, but the plaintiff must also know about whether the disease is temporary or permanent. There is no question that this is a departure from the law of this state, regardless of the test that the court
has. What didn't happen to the workers' comp?
Your Honor, my understanding is that it's still pending. That's my understanding. The counsel probably
Was there anything in the record that the test required could have been paid for by the
My understanding is, in order to be fair to the plaintiffs, is that the claim was controverted and that the only evidence, at least in the record of which I am aware, is that the insurance carrier denied payment for those bills. That's what Mr. Martinez says. Frankly, if the facts are different, I just do not know, but that's the record that's before us. I'm a little bit troubled about going down that road just because of free health care and the fact that the plaintiff's lawyer is the one who ultimately sent him to those doctors. I submit to the court that arguing that financial consideration should come into play in this case is probably misconstrued because he obviously did get to a doctor and he did get the biopsy and someone paid for it. It seems to me it could have been done much earlier. And the whole question about whether financial status should impact the running of the statute of limitation, that's a slope down which I'm not so sure this court ought to go. If, in fact, the Court of Appeals is correct that the permanence of the injury is a controlling factor to determine the accrual of the statute of limitation, that runs contrary to the law that this court has announced at least three times in the last 6 months. In the Murphy versus Campbell case, the court held that the cause of action accrues when the plaintiff is legally injured, however slight. In the Valsipol Chemical case, the court will recall that was a case involving damage as a result of chlordane, which is a chemical. The issue in that case was the cross plaintiff was arguing limitations should not run until the chlordane reached a particular level. The court said, no, once you know that chlordane is dangerous, that starts the running of the statute of limitation. The Kenneco Energy case, the cause of action accrues when the plaintiff has facts required to assert the cause of action. The opinion of the Court of Appeals also conflicts with Marino. It conflicts with Russell, in which the court held the cause of action accrues when the fact of injury is known, and there are a number of other cases. Addressing the policy. Should this court change the rule that the Court of Appeals wants to announce and make it a permanent injury rather than a temporary one? It seems to me and it seems to us that this type of rule would defeat the whole purpose of the statute of limitations. We talk about preventing claims from becoming stale. More specifically, we want to prevent evidence, witnesses from disappearing, memories fading. And clearly, if we wait until there is a understanding of a permanent nature, we think that would undermine the whole policy underlying the statute of limitations. Two quick points. Number one, this court is familiar with exposure cases. One of the critical issues in these cases always is product identification. And as time goes on, trying to identify products to whom or to which a person may have been exposed 20 or 25 years ago clearly presents a problem. If we include not only waiting until the plaintiff has knowledge of injury, but until the plaintiff has knowledge of permanent injury, we just exacerbate the problem. And recall also, what the statute of limitations does, it says the time starts to run for which the plaintiff must make an inquiry. The plaintiff has 2 years to decide if, in fact, he or she has a cause of action.
Let's assume that this one had not gone to the doctor but had symptoms. At what point along the continuum do the early symptoms, the middle stage symptoms, at what point are you placed on?
Two responses. The first is, depending on which way this court goes in terms of what is the test, is it knowledge of injury or is it knowledge of injury plus cause? That might have an impact on Your Honor's decision as to where the continuum goes. Also, I think you need to understand, or we all need to understand, at what point in time are those symptoms connected with the injury? If the symptoms are connected with the injury, that seems to me that statute of limitations begins to run when the symptoms in fact manifest themselves. Now, if the court is going to say, well, we're a little concerned about that because it may be a very minor thing, then maybe you want to engraft on the causation issue. If I have a symptom that I know is related to exposure to silicon, then it seems to me the statute of limitations begins to run right there. And I have 2 years to determine, to make the inquiry, and then the question becomes, what are the damages that I have suffered as a result of that exposure? For what am I suing? Remember also that at the time of trial, one of the issues is going to be what are the future damages that this person is going to suffer. So the jury looks at this particular plaintiff at that point in time, and if the plaintiff has very little symptoms, but has evidence that is credible before the jury that he or she is going to develop a horrible disease, that is compensable. But in terms of the statute of limitations, if the symptom is it.
Let's talk about the asbestos case, for example. Let's assume that someone has pleural thickening and the doctors say, we can't say if you will develop asbestos or lung cancer. You may or you may not. But you're saying you have to go ahead and sue them when you know that you have the early stages that may or may not lead to a deadly or debilitating disease.
As an aside, that's not what we have to
do,
obviously.
I'm probing what you call the knowledge of the injury.
Certainly. Two points. The first is, if the person either has asbestos or does not have asbestos, right? If that person, in fact, has asbestos and the symptoms are consistent with the asbestos, and a doctor says, well, you don't have it, we run into the misdiagnosis problem that I think, one of the justices mentioned earlier. And then the question is, do you visit upon the defendant the misdiagnosis by the doctor? If, in fact, the person does not have the disease, then there's no problem because there's no limitations to run. But what it really ties into is the question about whether this court is going to include causation into the test. Because if we have injury plus causation, then it seems the statute does begin to run. And I don't think there is anything. I have a disease and it's going to get worse. That is what trials are all about in terms of future damage. And certainly a plaintiff, it happens all the time where a plaintiff's expert gets on the stand and says, here are the symptoms. They are consistent with a permanent injury that is going to arise. And I'm not so sure, I may come before you at another time to argue a different position, but in the theoretical field, I think that's compensable. Something the jury's going to have to decide.
Well, in the silicosis cases, let's say he starts with a persistent cough and doctors say, we can't tell you. It's going to take more time for us to diagnose whether you have silicosis. When is limitations along that continuum? When do you know that you have an injury? And you know that you're a sandblaster, so if you get it, you know where it came from.
It depends about the injury for which you are seeking compensation. If the plaintiff is seeking compensation because he or she is coughing and has the symptoms, it seems to me the limitations runs at the point at which he or she has those symptoms. If the doctor says, and it's consistent with everything that we know in medical literature, if the doctor says, you do not have silicosis right now, You may develop it, but you don't have it. If the plaintiff then tries to sue for silicosis 2 years after it, he in fact has it, I think that's reasonable. But again, of course, that's not what we have here, because here we have where he knows he's got it.
So but you're saying limitations does depend upon medical science's ability to diagnose?
Again, it depends which test this court wants to adopt. If the test is, and I think it's because it's never written, if the test is because that we're going to have knowledge of injury alone, then the statute of limitations begins to accrue at that point without knowing the cause. If, however, this court says we're going to have injury plus, in general, knowledge of causation, that's a different test. And that may come into play when we decide is the person, should the person be charged with filing with an inquiry into a cause of action upon the symptoms or upon a general knowledge that we have not only symptoms but a link to something such as occupational disease.
What you're saying is that silicosis is a developing disease.
Yes, sir, it is.
And just because you're exposed to silica dust and you cough doesn't mean you have silicosis.
That's correct.
But it could turn out that 2 years later, you may develop diagnosable silicosis.
Yes, sir.
And if I understand what you said a second ago, you say that the statute of limitations should not run on a silicosis claim until the disease is diagnosed. I mean, how could you sue for silicosis until you have silicosis?
Well, that's right. I'm not so sure I use the term diagnosis. That gets us down. I'm not so sure I want to go. But again, if the person is going to sue for the symptom when he first gets the coughing, well, you might think it's not too much for his damages, but that's when it starts if he's going to sue for the coughing. And there's a question, I suspect, about whether, there's a question of science, about whether the coughing is in fact enough of a symptom to establish silicosis. But let's assume for purposes of your question that, by gosh, he doesn't have silicosis, no question about it, until 5 years later. It seems to me making him file a cause of action for silicosis before he has it creates a problem. That is, I would not be for you arguing that. But again, I don't want to lose sight of the fact that that's not what we have here. Thank you.
May it please the court, Mr. Greg Thompson will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Greg Thompson. I practice law down in Beaumont, Texas. It's my honor to be here before this court representing Jose Martinez. The standard that I believe with respect to the discovery rule, I don't think anybody argues the discovery rule doesn't apply. The question is, how do you apply the discovery rule in these cases? And if you look at the federal cases that started to deal with occupational diseases in the early 70s and in the 80s, which is where most of the cases were filed in those days, they actually talk about the discovery of the injury and its cause. The Glasscock versus Armstrong court case at the 946 Fed Second 1085 discusses injury and its cause. The Mann versus H. Robbins case discusses injury and its cause at 741 Fed Second 79. These are cited in our brief. And then recently, quite frankly, the Houston Court of Appeals, the First District, in a case called Steele versus Ron Poulin, which is not cited in our brief, but it's 1997 Westlaw 703795. November 1997, discusses the exact issue on a brain cancer case. Brain cancer was diagnosed, didn't know the cause. Statute didn't start to run until a year and a half later when they found out what the cause of the brain cancer was.
Mr. Thompson, even in that framework, why would it not be true that as of October 31, 1989, that your client knew or should have known, or at a minimum was put on inquiry to find out that he had a lung disease related to being exposed to silica dust?
Well, Judge, first off, the fact that the dates we agree with, the inferences of the facts they put up there, we do not agree with. And with respect to what Mr. Martinez knew, he testified in his deposition. He did not know he was ill. And as a matter of fact, what he specifically stated, and that's the summary judgment evidence before this court that we're here on, is first, I didn't know what he had, talking about his brother had. I didn't know what silicosis was. Talks about himself, and I'll talk about why did he file the claim, and I'll go into that in more detail, just for precaution. And then he says, I didn't know I was ill. that's the summary judgment evidence that we come before this court on. And it's important to actually understand that.
Wait. You're saying he says he did not know he was ill, or he did not know he had silicosis?
He said, I did not know he was ill, and later on, it's clear he didn't know he had silicosis. And there is no evidence that he thought he had silicosis until Dr. Gerslaw in 1991 told him he had silicosis.
What date is it you're saying he said that he did not know he was ill?
When the compensation claim was filed, he was asked why he filed it in 1989. His testimony that's in the record, in the transcript, I think it's 1489 or 1508, is that I didn't know I was ill. I filed it as a precaution. And I'll discuss that. But it's important to know we're here on summary judgment. And on summary judgment, we're not on an even playing field. I mean, the field is tilted squarely and heavily in favor of the non-movement. All inferences, all statements that he says are to be taken as true. All inferences and indulgences where there are fact disputes are to be taken in favor of the non-moving party. And with respect to the issues that they've discussed, I'll discuss those in order. He actually, in 1983, they don't put the date up there. He had a normal chest x-ray in 1983. That's in the record. Everything is okay. Doesn't know of any problems. 1985, they talked about, well, your brother was in the hospital with silicosis. You knew that your brother had silicosis. The record says the summary judgment evidence does establish he didn't know what silicosis was. And here's his answer that he gave that's in the record. First, I didn't know what he had. He told me later on, but when he mentioned silicosis, I never thought that it was an illness. I thought it was an allergy that was affecting him. What I'm trying to say is I didn't know what silicosis was. In 1989, he has a little bit of shortness of breath. And if you know from the issues of what causes shortness of breath and handling cases for 16 years, every doctor will tell you there's hundreds of causes of pulmonary fibrosis, and there's probably thousands of causes of shortness of breath. He had some shortness of breath. Much like the claimant in the earlier case, he went to a lawyer who, as a matter of precaution, filed a comp claim. And he didn't say silicosis. There's no mention of sandblasting on the claim. He said had a lung disease. With respect to...
Would you think it would make a difference in the world?
If my client, unlike the client in the case before us, didn't think he had silicosis, didn't think he was ill. In the case before us, he thought he had silicosis, and it turned out that the doctor said, well, we don't think you do. My client didn't know he was ill, didn't think that. The lawyer filed a claim for him of a lung disease. And the summary judgment evidence showed what my client understood about why that claim was filed. And we'll discuss in detail why my client understood it. Why did he file the claim? Why did the lawyer file the claim? You know, in 1989, there are different standards for comp claims versus third-party claims. There's a 30-day time limit to give an employer notice of first manifestation of any disease, or you may lose your right to pursue that claim. And so that lawyer, if you notice, that lawyer's first manifestation date he put in there is within 30 days of the date he filed the claim. But he may have been very worried about limitations running on a comp claim on why he filed it.
There's a fact issue then as to when he was on actual construction.
Absolutely. There is
and that fact issue is raised by his testimony that I know this is what the comp claim form says, but here's what I really thought at the time.
That's correct. And Your Honor, one of the other things in context we have to understand is this is a working class immigrant person that is not highly educated. He had a ninth grade education in Mexico. He doesn't speak English fluently. There was an interpreter in the deposition. He doesn't read English. The thing that was filed in English. I mean, what he said was that I didn't know I was ill. I filed it as a precaution. And the different standards that in those days, quite frankly, lawyers may have let claims to be filed, they lay dormant for 9 or 10 years because they weren't in a court. They were before an industrial accident board, and the claims would just sit there for years. And they may have, in fact, thought the disease may catch up with the claim.
What's the status of this one?
This claim is pending. It is still pending, I guess, 8, 9 years later. But it's undisputed in this case that no doctor ever told Mr. Martinez that he had silicosis or a lung disease before 1990. No one
is there any evidence about whether a doctor could have told him that?
Well, the only evidence is he did act within the... If you said 1989 was the date, that's when it started, you better do something within 2 years. He did actually go to a Dr. Weisenfeld within that 2-year time period. Dr. Weisenfeld was an allergist in Midland, which is the big city compared to Odessa. And Dr. Weisenfeld said, I don't know what's wrong with you. We need to find out some more stuff. So he actually did exercise due diligence and go to a doctor who said, I don't know what's wrong with you. I guess we've got to look at some more things.
But
what about the year gap between the date he says he's got to have a biopsy and the date of the biopsy?
The year gap, first off, there's no evidence as to who paid for any of that test for Dr. Weisbach or Dr. Gearslaw. The year gap, Your Honor, the only thing I can tell you is that Mr. Martinez was on food stamps. The record shows he had no bank account. Mr. Martinez did not have much money. Mr. Martinez lived in a city, Odessa, Texas, in which board-certified occupational physicians, or B-readers, don't abound on every corner. And he did, in fact, go to who he thought was a good doctor, Dr. Weisenfeld, in Midland. So there is no evidence in the record as to the year time period, except the evidence is he was financially distraught during that time period.
But do you believe, then, that that's a fact that it should be considered by the court when they are looking at the due diligence?
Honestly, yes, sir, I believe it's a fact issue because it's for the jury. Because I believe there's a fact issue regarding this whole matter about the context of which it was in. What Dr. Weisenfeld told him when he went to a doctor and said, I can't diagnose you with anything. I'm not sure what you have. I mean, those are all intertwined, and that's one of the reasons why this court, I guess in 1943, in the Robeck case, talked about why these questions, and it was not a discovery rule case, but 1943 in the Robeck versus Hunt case.
Well, that gets back to the financial factor. It cuts the other way, too. If you have all kinds of coverage or cash to pay for the treatment and you don't go, you can still then argue, well, you had the money and you should have gone. And obviously, well, you didn't have the money, but you should have gone.
I don't disagree with that, Judge. I believe that's why a jury is particularly well-suited to hear the evidence regarding these things. And if the jury makes a determination that you knew about the injury but you waited too long, you know, so be it. But those things are intricately tied up with the factual issues. And in 1943, this court, in a fraud case, which had a kind of discovery rule statute.
Well, then, as your argument, but there are excuses for lack of due diligence that a party is permitted to put into the record,
there,
rather than the inquiry, were they diligent or not after they discovered that they have symptoms and an injury has occurred.
I think all the relevant facts enter into the calculus, determining whether or not due diligence was exercised. I will tell you that my own belief is he did not believe that he had silicosis in 1989. There is no evidence in the record that says he believed it. There is no evidence in the record that says any doctor told him it. There is no evidence in the record that said an employment notation. And if you look at these cases, you see where the kind of evidence that bars claims come from. Doctor's notation. I told him he had asbestosis in 1983. Notations from the employer saying he was told that he had asbestos disease 5 years ago. Notations from other claimants saying, yeah, he told me that he was sick with asbestos 6 years ago. That's where these issues
well,
come up before the court. They're not here in this case.
What did the record show that his brother told him that his brother had silicosis?
In 1985, his brother told him he had silicosis. The record says that. And then
his answer is, I didn't know what it was.
That is the summary judgment evidence.
But he had the same symptoms.
No, he didn't have the same. He was never hospitalized for it. Well, he had slight shortness of breath.
And you argued he didn't do that because he didn't have the money to go.
Well, the summary judgment evidence before this court was, I didn't know I was ill. I didn't know what silicosis was. I thought it was an allergy. And Judge, quite frankly, if you looked at the doctor he saw in Midland, he was an allergist. I mean, to me, it's a jury question that all of this information goes into the calculus to determine that.
Mr. Thompson, let me ask you this. Looking at September 1989, says client has a lung disease arising out of and in the course of his employment. And talks about cause damages to his lungs. Why would that not put him on notice that he needs to go see a doctor to figure out if he really does have a problem?
Well, Judge, what he testified as to, and remember the context, this is a working class immigrant who can't read English and can't speak English, and whose lawyer filed this statement. Okay. He says, I filed it as a precaution. I didn't know I was ill. Didn't believe I was ill. You know, it never stopped me from working. All I had was some slight shortness of breath, which quite frankly, if you've been going through these cases, every time you've ever proposed a plaintiff, shortness of breath is ubiquitous. It is ever present. But if it did put him on notice, Judge, the Surratt case, which is an interesting case out of the Houston Court of Appeals, because of what they say is part of what the law requires. The Surratt case actually says the burden is on the defendant in a summary judgment case on limitation to prove that he had an injury before that day of 1989. But they have to prove that there was an injury. And in this case, there's no proof other than a comp claim that has no objective medical evidence to substantiate it, that there's any injury in 1989. He had shortness of breath, but he didn't think he was ill.
Well, let me ask you a question. You're trying to make a point, but I'm concerned. It may be one thing to say, I don't know why the lawyer filed a comp claim, but it's entirely different when a client says, I'm not ill, I don't think I'm ill, I'm not sick, but I'm going to go get a lawyer. I mean, it seems to me that at some point, his actions should take precedence over his words. And he obviously thought something because he went to hire a lawyer. And he obviously thought something that he told the lawyer that indicated the lawyer that in order to be a precaution, he needs to put the employer on notice that there may have been an injury. It seems to me that the court cannot condone a claimant to later on say, I didn't mean it. I mean, it seems to me we can't ignore a comp claim that's filed. He might not know what the claim was. But it seems to me we can't ignore his conduct in attempting to obtain a benefit based on an injury by simply allowing him after the fact to say, well, I didn't know I was ill. I didn't think I was ill. I didn't think there was anything wrong. I mean, it seems it goes too far to say, in a summary judgment context, ignore his actions and accept only what he says in his deposition.
Well, I think that quite frankly, all evidence that he says has to be taken as true. However, let's look at the 1989 comp filing. The comp filing was not for silicosis. It did not say silicosis. It did not say that I know that I was exposed to silica, I'm a sandblaster. It didn't say any of that stuff. Unlike the case before us where the comp filing said I had silicosis, I believed I had silicosis, I thought I had silicosis, it said none of that. And the summary judgment evidence is that he didn't know he was ill. Why the lawyer did what he did in 1989, I theorized, but he did something without medical documentation, without medical diagnosis. And quite frankly, much like the judge's question earlier about should you be able to go into something that has not been medically proven yet, he didn't know anything about it. And he did take some, and he did go see a doctor. And the doctor said, I don't know. What is your problem? And in addition to that, the insurance company controverted his workers' compensation claims, and there's no evidence of any occupational disease. We're not going to pay for any medical treatment or any medical thing because there's just no evidence of anything like that.
Your case aside, this doesn't really change as much to your case as the prior one, but in the context where the law has statute of repose for injuries that occur in construction and engineering and architectural projects, and has adverse possession statutes that require after a certain specific time, then title may change. Should the discovery rule operate to permit a cause of action 30, 40, 50 years after the injury first happened? Talking earlier, birth defect or some exposure to chocolate milk, when it takes that long to determine that there really was a serious injury at that time?
I think historically we always have, Judge, and I think that I've done this for 16 years now, and I've been in depositions with many of the same lawyers time and time again. Remember that the burden of proof is on the plaintiff. The burden of going forward is on the plaintiff. They have to prove what products they were exposed to. This court has rejected market share liability, at least in the situation that was brought to this court. They have the burden of proof to prove whose products they were exposed to. They have the burden of proof under the Havner opinion this court has issued to prove causation under stringent requirements. So the burden of proof is on the plaintiff. And I think, quite frankly, if you look like in Urey versus Tompkins, the original blameless ignorance rule, if someone is a DES baby and is born with a birth defect, and maybe they know about the injury as a child, but it isn't until 12 years later that everyone finds out that DES was the cause of this horrible monstrosity, and the DES people may have known about it, but hid it, or examples like that. If in fact those are the cases, yes, I think it's reasonable to go forward with that kind of case, and it's reasonable for limitations the discovery rule to apply.
But that's the fraudulent concealment as opposed to the discovery rule.
No, sir, I believe it is not fraudulent concealment.
Just anyway.
Well, no, because until they learned of the cause of DES causing
you said in your example that they knew about it and they concealed it.
If they knew about it but didn't disclose it, that actually isn't relevant to whether or not the discovery rule should apply. It should apply until they learned of the cause of it. Maybe one of the reasons they didn't learn of the cause, science may not have caught up. Or they may have hit the danger.
And you make the argument that it's fraudulent concealment, that you could and should have a longer time before you have reason to know what you should know?
Well, Judge, and that's what the Robeck case was, a case of fraud in which this court first really talked about the discovery rule for discovering the fraud. I don't think it's necessary in this particular case to discuss whether or not you need fraudulent concealment.
I don't disagree with that comment.
Well, Judge, I mean, I believe that I have not abused the example, respectfully, but what I believe is that in this particular case, if we start taking an allowance that the discovery rule is only going to apply the day that first someone has symptoms, this court in the Grinnell case talked about maybe there's a cause of action for cigarette smoking under various, for an addiction issue under very specific circumstances. Is the first cough that a smoker has going to put him on notice that he better file that claim? Is it the first hack?
Counsel, I think you've answered the question.
Thank you.
Mr. Schroeder, sir.
No.
Oh, excuse me.
I promise I'll be brief. I will. Literally 1 minute.
I was hoping for time back.
You will get some. When does the inquiry start? That is the test. Not when it's completed, not that we know we have silicosis. When did the duty to inquire start? He had symptoms in August 31st of 89. He says that's when there was the first manifestation of disease. He felt badly enough, as Justice Enoch pointed out, to go see a lawyer to file a claim. We do not encourage the frivolous filing of workers' compensation claims. He obviously felt badly enough that he pursued this. There is no claim in this case that the ultimate lawsuit for silicosis, the third party action today, is any different than the subject of the workers' compensation claim. We would ask that the court reverse the opinion of the Board of Appeals.
All right.